Down with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Tuesday. Well, it's been Tuesday for a while. It's a little bit presumptuous of me to welcome you to it, but welcome to the Tuesday edition of the show. How's that? A little better? Thank you. We've got stuff to go back to from last night that we didn't get to, and then we've got stories fresh for tonight. And you'll pardon me if I'm a little sleepy. Didn't get a lot of rest last night. I told you there was a storm blowing through here. Well, it blew through all right. It blew through and took off some more shingles. And there's nothing to really keep you from getting a good night's rest quite like arguing with one's lovely spouse over whether or not said spouse should switch places in bed with you so that the dripping ceiling would drip on you instead of said lovely spouse. Suffice to say, the lovely spouse, namely Agnes, argued about that. No. But yeah, I got up this morning, picked up some shingles out of the yard, looked at a bunch of them just sort of standing at a 90-degree angle, sort of boldly against the weather, whence the wind had come. You know, sometimes this rural home ownership thing gets to be just a little bit of a challenge. But it is what it is. And you know, you may have heard last night when I told Sandra the story of getting shaken down and rousted by one of the local county constabulary types. That was exciting. And the other thing that got done today is the magnificent rusty red pickup truck. The 16-year-old rusty red pickup truck has a new inspection sticker on it, so pull me over, officer friendly. Pull me over. If you're feeling lucky. Well, are ya? Cop. Nah, see, that's a little too much bravado. But, yeah, so it's been a busy day. Agnes was at the doctor's office. I was at the doctor's office. Good news. Finally got the results from my little radioactive scan last week. And there's nothing going sideways inside me, so that's real nice. Except the parts that are going sideways inside me that we don't know why. So, you know, we'll just take it as good news and, you know, the heirs to the problems of the flesh and all of that kind of stuff and, you know, whatever. But that leads us to here, to tonight. Roughly 4 minutes past the hour, we begin the program this evening with something that I like to call nice work if you can get it. And, of course, it has to do, obviously, with the Republican Party. Now, bear in mind that in budget discussions this week, the Congressional Black Caucus, and in particular, Congressional Black Caucus Chairman Representative Emanuel Cleaver, a Democrat from Missouri and a fine human being, it was late last week in a meeting with the White House, mentioned to President Not Sure that there was a program in contemplation, or that it had been, in contemplation, that would have provided some level of relief to unemployed persons, and in particular the 99ers. Representative Cleaver said after the March 30th meeting that his staff had found that the cost of that program would be between $14 and $20 billion, which is cost prohibitive. So there was no point in the president saying, yeah, I support it. They just kind of treated it as dead on arrival. So, 99ers, screw you. Got that? It's a fairly brief message. I hope you won't have a hard time comprehending it. That's screw you. That's not me saying that. It's not how I feel. But still, screw you. Okay, so we got that. We've got a great big to the 99ers out there. Well, that leaves our betters, doesn't it? And that brings us to the good work if you can get it department. We have two exemplars from the good work if you can get it department. One is someone with whom you are familiar, another one is someone with whom you are not. One is from Wisconsin, the other is from Alaska. Are you beginning to sort these into categories yet? Good. I knew you would. One is that dancing teen mom, Bristol Palin. And the other is a cat by the name of... it's right here somewhere. Yeah. Brian DeShane. Brian DeShane. On the one hand, in the good work if you can get it department, it turns out that paperwork was released in the last few days from an organization called the Candies Foundation. You know, Candies is an apparel and shoe line. And they hired Bristol Palin, you know, teen mom Bristol Palin, who already has a baby, Bristol Palin. They hired her for their I Vow Not Now campaign against teen pregnancy. Now, the Candies Foundation is a 501c3 charitable organization, nonprofit. You're going to love this. They paid because, you know, they've got a campaign. The Candies Foundation has a campaign. I think it is I Vow Not Now. They've got this campaign against teen pregnancy. They paid ABC Family $165,000 to run their teen pregnancy ad that featured Bristol Palin and something or someone called, see, I'm displaying what an out-of-touch geek I am. They paid someone called The Situation to make this public service announcement advising young women to not be pregnant while they're teenagers. I know.
Hey. Well, excuse me, miss. Have you ever had a situation with the official situation?
Excuse me, Sitch?
Oh, snap, B. Palin.
You mean to tell me that girls actually fall for that line?
Come on, I mean, if those words don't work, I got the situation right there.
I hope you're as committed to safe sex as you are those abs.
I know you're all about that abstinence thing, you know, but, I mean, come on, B. Palin, are you serious? Like, you're not going to hook up with Like before you married? For real?
For real.
For real.
Wait, stop. I can't stand it. Did you catch that line? I mean, we're not doing any highfalutin William Shakespeare textual criticism or nothing. Let's go back. Okay, so this guy's in some sort of white leisure suit with a black shirt unbuttoned down to his pubic bone and lots of tacky chains and shit hanging around on it a strange, to say the least, haircut that involves leaving a little patch of hair on the top of his otherwise odd little head and a pair of sunglasses in his hand. I guess I'll have to go check with the teenagers to find out if that is, sexually appealing. I just happen to have some teenagers here. I'll ask them after the program just to make sure, just to find out how geeky old dad is. But get the dialogue.
About that abstinence thing, you know, but, I mean, come on, B. Palin, are you serious? Like, you're not going to hook up with, like, before you married? For real?
For real.
For real, for real?
For real, for real, for real.
All right.
You're not going to hook up, and I realize that I am halfway to geezerdom, especially in the eyes of my children. You're not going to hook up before you're married. Married. For real? For real, for real. For real, for real, for real? For real. What are we to assume, then, about little Trip Keyshawn Flapjack Johnston? You know, the product of Bristol Palin having hooked up, as they say. Hooked up, that's what those hepcat kids talk. That's how they talk nowadays. You know, she's kind of round-faced. She doesn't have the blue shawl over her head that makes her walk it look like a walking clitoris or anything like the Virgin Mary. But I guess we are to assume from this ad that she is, in fact, a regenerated virgin. Something inside me tells me that Bristol Palin probably doesn't know what parthenogenesis means, and asking her to spell it would merely be an exercise in futility. But nonetheless, I digress.
All right, well, you know what? I mean, just in case you do get into a situation, I want to make sure that you are situated. Because if you do get into a situation with your situation, you may end up with a situation, and you may not like that situation.
Trust me, though, I'm not getting myself into another situation. I know.
Ah, another situation, so we don't have to worry about getting her to either spell or attempt to pronounce, let alone comprehend, parthenogenesis.
How hard it is to be a teen parent.
You know what? I totally respect that. And I totally respect abstinence. I mean, it actually has the word abstinence. I'm the situation. I love that.
Very funny. But I'm worried about you and you practicing safe sex.
I actually practice a whole lot. I mean, a whole lot.
Talk about the safe part of that.
The safe part, we got the safe part down pat. What pile? Magnums. You know what? I might be able to spare one. I mean, you know, I'll give you one.
It's fine. I avoid situations.
All right, good, good. If you're good at avoiding situations and you're situated...
Well, she avoids situations except that one situation that wound up with a situation by the name of Trip Keyshawn Flapjack Johnston. You know, I owe Bart Cop big... time for that. We still laugh every now and then Ferg or one of the girls will walk through and they'll just what? And like, Trip Keyshawn Flapjack Johnston. It may be the funniest thing Bart Cop ever did. I avoid situations,
and I'm situated. Situations under control.
Well, I'm glad that we agree on one thing. Pause before you play.
Pause before you play, that's probably the most important thing. You gotta think before you get into a situation. A PBYP, that ain't no PB&J sandwich. Right? What pie? Snap!
With the condom. Oh dear. Okay, so that cost, that running that ad on ABC Family or something, cost the Candies Foundation $165,000. But, you know, that was fulfilling the mission, right? I guess. Well, in addition to the $165,000 that the Candies Foundation paid to ABC Family to air that scintillating after-school drama, they also paid $25,000 to the Mount Sinai Adolescent Health Center. It's a teen pregnancy health and counseling clinic. And they paid $10,000 to the National Campaign to Prevent Teen Pregnancy. Okay, so that's 25 plus 10, that's 35, plus 165, that's $200,000. If you count running the ad. If you count actually giving money to, as a charitable foundation, that's what you do, you give away money, mind you. If you don't count the cost of the ad, which ran for a very limited period of time, and I must tell you, we were not compensated in any wise for running it here. Can't imagine somebody getting paid for running that anywhere. Then the sum total of what the Candies Foundation gave to organizations that actually deal with the real-life, no-kidding crisis that is teen pregnancy equals, drumroll please, stand by, $35,000, and that's it. The Candies Foundation gave less than the cost of a lot of automobiles to organizations that actually deal with teen pregnancy and crises and stuff. Yeah, right. Okay, so what, Bob? This segment's called Good Work If You Can Get It. Where does that come in? Well, where that comes in is the check that was mailed to Ms. Bristol Palin at 711 H Street, Suite 620, Anchorage, ACK, 99501-3442. And, well, it was a check. Like I said, this is called the Good Work If You Can Get It department. That check was in the amount, sit down, especially if you're a 99er, or a working person who can not only spell but comprehend the idea of the word parthenogenesis, sit down. That check was in the amount of $262,500, made payable to Ms. Bristol Palin. For those of you who, like me, have a hard time doing mathematics on the fly, the Candies Foundation paid Bristol Palin seven times more than what it actually paid to real organizations that deal with the ongoing highly volatile crisis situation, oh, there's that word, of teen pregnancy. In other words, the Candies Foundation paid a young woman who could not stay out of a teen pregnancy seven times more than what they paid to organizations to help keep young women out of teen pregnancies. Got that? Yeah, G. Bristol. Don't spend it all in one place. Good work if you can get it. I know. Jim says, the sounds like 70s disco drag to me. Jumping up and down after doesn't work? Well, just ask Bristol. And then this from Ron and Raleigh. Please, Bob, have mercy. Let me get this straight. They hired an unwed mother and a Jersey Shore musclehead. to shill for abstinence. Man, how stupid do they think we are? Really stupid, I guess, says Ron in Raleigh. And what's sad is that not only that, you know what, we'll hire Bristol Palin and that situation fellow because they're happening teens who can really identify with the teens and they know how to talk and flash their condoms and things, and we will fight teen pregnancy that way. Facepalm. Good work if you can get it. But as it turns out, this Tuesday, the 5th day of April, is not the... There's more than one good work if you can get it story. I've already mentioned the name. Yes. Of Brian DeShane. Brian DeShane... Well, if Brian DeShane was one of our kids, Brian DeShane would be in a world of hurt. Brian DeShane would be sweating bullets. Brian DeShane is 26 years old. What was it? Let's see. What was it last night? Last night, John Boehner, in an excerpt from that Rolling Stone interview with Matt Taibbi. John Boehner said, "Well, these kids nowadays, they get out of college and think that they're automatically entitled to make $24K. $24,000. Large, large money at 24K. Well, Brian DeShane didn't get out of college and think that he was entitled to make 24K because, well, Brian DeShane didn't get out of college. Now, there's no shame in not having gone to college. There's no shame in not being able to finish college. That's a reality for a lot of young people in this country. Just can't get through. Just costs too much. And if the person involved is actually learning from it, I guess there's, you can say also that there's no shame in being 26 years old, a college dropout from the University of Wisconsin, and having two prior DUI convictions. No shame in that. But it's interesting that John Boehner hasn't come out and said anything about Brian DeShane, because John Boehner apparently thinks that it is somehow offensive that a recent college graduate would have the unmitigated temerity to think that they are worth $24,000 a year. Keep that number handy. Because Brian DeShane was hired by Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker recently. And we know the whole sorry Scott Walker story, right? Right. And we know that Scott Walker is terribly, terribly, terribly concerned about Wisconsin's budget shortfalls. Right. None of that, however, prevented Wisconsin Governor, hopefully for a very short time, Scott Walker. Nothing prevented Scott Walker from hiring Brian DeShane for a salary that equals $81,500 a year. I know, I can hear it from here. There's a lot of you going, what? Yeah, really. $81,500 a year for a 26-year-old Wisconsin University of Wisconsin-Madison college dropout with two DUIs. After only 2 months on the job, DeShane has already received a 26% pay raise and a promotion. He must be something, this Brian DeShane. I mean, my God, he must be, I don't know, reinventing the electric light or something. $81,500 a year. He'd better be, shoot, I mean, something, he'd better know something involving, I don't know, the chaos theory or the string theory or bring it, making gold out of lead or, no. What it boils down to is Brian DeShane passed Scott Walker's DNA test. Yeah, the DNA testing is not only for unwed fathers. No. DNA testing also comes in awfully handy when one is looking for work in an administration run by the usual suspects, i.e., crony, Jim Hightower called them kleptocrats. That's right. The DNA test has to do with the fact that Brian DeShane is the son of Jerry DeShane. Now, who is Jerry DeShane? You certainly must ask. Well, DeShane is a big mover and shaker among Republican politico types. He is big in home building in Wisconsin. When he was asked about it, he said, you know, I may have put in a good word with Scott Walker for my boy. And, in fact, Keith Gilkes, who is the chief of staff for Scott Walker, did, in fact, recommend Brian DeShane for an interview with Wisconsin state government. Yeah. Just put in a good word for him. That's all it was. Yeah, he's a nice kid. He's trying to pick himself up from a couple of big-time life mistakes, you know, dropping out of college and getting a couple of DUIs. And just put in a good word for him, that's all. Well, not really. Jerry DeShane put in a good word for his son, Brian. And the fact of the matter is that good word, well, you want to know what that good word, it was several good words. The good words that Brian DeShane put in with Scott Walker for, or Jerry DeShane put in with Scott Walker for his son Brian, the good words he put in with him were $121,652. Because that is the total of the amount that Jerry DeShane's trade group, in conjunction with Jerry DeShane himself, gave to Scott Walker and his running mate, Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clefish. Clefish? That just sounds like that. Jesus, you got Clefish? Really? I don't know. I put some hydrogen peroxide on it or something. Clefish. Yeah, he was one of the, Jerry DeShane was one of the top five PAC donors to Scott Walker's gubernatorial campaign. $121,652. But we haven't gotten to the fun part yet. It is quite likely you will see more stories like this coming out of Wisconsin, sort of rising up like dandelions after a rain. We're in spring now, so we use springtime analogies. The anti-union law that Scott Walker signed last month that may or may not be legal, depending on whether or not you think that, you know, things, silly things like courts and their opinions actually matter. Well, there's a provision in that law that converts more than 37 civil service positions into political appointees chosen by the governor. I guess somebody's been putting in a lot of good words with Scott Walker. You know, good words like, $121,652. But wait, there's more. So, yeah, it's political patronage. And the thing you do with political patronage is you put the recipients of, say, of said patronage, you put them somewhere that they really can't hurt anybody or hurt themselves, right? Right. Only no. No, not really. Because Brian DeShane, University of Wisconsin-Madison College dropout, and recipient of two, not one, but two, driving under the influence of alcohol convictions, now has literally dozens of Wisconsin Department of Commerce employees under him. What are they doing? You know, I remember when our buddy Albert told us about the coal waste depository that they were trying to build in his neck of Wisconsin and how infuriated he was about it. Yeah, because you're not going to like this. Albert, if you're listening, sit down. Wisconsinites and Wisconsinians, whatever we call you, sit down. Brian DeShane, who had a good word put in for him with the Mr. Gilkey and Mr. Walker and Ms. Cleefish. Brian DeShane is now in charge of state. Man, this is tough for me. Brian DeShane is now in charge of state environmental and regulatory issues. You know, call me crazy, but I'd really want somebody who we were pretty sure had passed a couple of science classes. Maybe an engineering class. Freshman comp in that job. You know, this story just brings up all kinds of possible images. Things like bad movies by dead former Saturday Night Live alums that feature David Spade. Right. Tommy Boy. That's it. Only I don't think this is going to have the happy ending Tommy Boy had. You take a ne'er-do-well son of a well-connected donor and you put him in a position where he can essentially screw up a department that you, as a Republican, probably rather despise in the first place. Dealing with, nasty, boring things like underground fuel storage tanks, which, when they rust out or leak, dump all manners of poisons into groundwater supplies, and I'm sure that there are people in Wisconsin who are on water wells and not public water, just like there are here in Appalachia. And Brian DeShane, Uncle Scott told me not to do, Governor Walker told me not to do anything about it. Is the check cleared? Really? $81,500 a year to a 26-year-old kid, young adult, with two DUIs. And I want to be clear. If he was a 26-year-old kid with two DUIs who actually had some functioning expertise in the field, maybe it would be different. But he doesn't. He doesn't at all. Well, I guess there's a reason I named this segment Good Work If You Can Get It. How many applicants are there for every job opening that comes up in the United States? Yeah. Just not a whole lot of $81,000 a year jobs out there, no matter how qualified the person. And this unqualified little punk is going to walk off with that much coin out of not some company's pocket, but out of the state treasury of the people of Wisconsin. At the same time, the teachers, firefighters, electricians, state social workers, people who see to the needs of abused, battered children, at the same time that their pay, which ain't nowhere near no $81,500, go begging. Good work if you can get it. So, you know, that's where we start the program. Ron noting, I think his expertise is in unified field theory. Let me see if I've got this straight. Governor Walker, fiscal hawk, gives a high-paying job to a ne'er-do-well son of a donor. So that now the people of Wisconsin are paying for their own butt-boning. I think you've pretty well nailed that one, nailed that pelt to the door, Ron. Does he do Walker under the desk, asks Jim. I can't even allow my brain to contemplate that imagery, but you know what? Maybe not under the desk, but over there at that Department of Environmental Hussis, he damn sure does. Huh? What? There's a bunch of toxic goo leaking into the groundwater of good, upstanding, God-fearing Wisconsinians? Well, it wouldn't be leaking if God hadn't wanted it to. Next! You know, there's something just essentially offensive about the birth lottery. About that whole born on third thinking you hit a triple thing. But it is for sure real. And when it works, and we see it working, it is for sure repugnant. So that's where we begin this evening. I got some other stuff, too. Of course I do. This program's 3 hours long, you know. But that's a great place to start the discussion. We live in a country that does not even have the time of day anymore for people who have given their very lives, because that's what we do when we go to work, isn't it? We give portions of our lives to make the overall economy of this country go. And our government is in the clutches of people who don't give a damn when those people who give their of their lives are simply thrown on the ash heap. Of an economic firestorm. You know, there's a reason that crowds in revolutions, I think I've got the word right, there's a reason that crowds in revolutions in foreign countries have looked at the people who have abused them and screamed, Pardon! to the wall and have proceeded to paint the wall red. There is a reason. I am nonviolent. I remain committed to the principles of nonviolence. I have great and abiding love in my heart for vast swaths of humanity. But I would damn sure be forgiving of a 99er, of which I guess I'm technically one. But I was a 99er so long ago it didn't really matter. I was a 99er before we ever started the horn. The 99ers could be forgiven for looking at the Brian Deshanes and the Bristol Palins of this world and just feeling an upsurging, rising from the depths upwelling of white hot rage. Not jealous rage, but the righteous indignation of being compelled to have their noses rubbed in the political corruption that washes over this nation like a giant sewer gone broken in the streets. As the Brian Deshanes and the Bristol Palins of the world cry, "Oh, piss boy! Piss boy!" Because that's what we are to them, if we are, in fact, that much. America's lazy, let's face it. The world needs ditch diggers, and you come from a family of ditch diggers. Or even the ditch diggers are disdained. 18 minutes before the hour, we'll take a little break and come back. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. Emphasis on listener-supported, I might add. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. In the immortal words of Jerry Reed, we've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. Any help you can give is more than appreciated. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. You know the call-in number, right? 877-443-2366. On your nickel, 304-658-3333.
Peace.
rest of it. There is just a nasty thumping bass in the back of that song. Jackson Brown, of course, and Somebody's Baby. Yeah, that was featured in what? Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Yeah. David in Tennessee noting, and he has some experience along these lines, to get a state job for 81 large usually means a Ph.D. and experience in a difficult field, if the hire is for good reason. Well, bear in mind, there's a little bit more detail to add to the Brian DeShane story. He got the job that I told you about, but he also had previously worked for then Wisconsin State Senators David Zien and Kathy Stepp, S-T-E-P-P. At least her name wasn't, what, Fishlick or whatever? But Kathy Stepp is somebody now. Kathy Stepp is the Natural Resources Secretary of Wisconsin. And gosh, when you're thinking about natural resources, well, you just kind of naturally think about nasty things that go into natural resources. And if you're a pig licking, you just want somebody there that will, huh, what? I was on the, what? I don't know. And so I guess that's the high level of expertise that was needed in this particular position. You can read the whole story if you want at jsonline.com. It's a column called No Quarter by Daniel Bice, B-I-C-E. No degree, little experience, payoff big. jsonline.com. That's the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel. No mean newspaper, I suppose. But look, it's not like we're surprised, is it? I bring you stories like this not because, well, I can't believe it. Believe it! Because this is what our repig-licking betters do and expect us to like it. God Almighty. Now the question is one of what we do with information like this. You reckon there are a few school teachers, firefighters, police officers, and so forth, a little bit more than aggravated by this? You reckon maybe Brian DeShane should be turned into the poster child for everything that is wrong with how Repiglicans run government? Or don't run government? Or run government into the ground? Yeah. Let's see. You know the number, 877-443-2366. Couple of lines open. Jump in if you want to. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Listen, you know the Bristol Palin story. I mean, oh God, I can't believe it. I mean, the bitch, that girl got almost $300,000, and the so-called charity paid out $35,000, and it just, the beat goes on with these folks. And I mean, it's just incredible that this girl is getting paid that much just because.
She's what, 19, 20 years old? How does a 19 or a 20 year old negotiate a $262,500 deal, Sandra? I guess that's the question I'm asking.
Well, it's absurd. Where's the sort of controls on these so-called nonprofits? I mean, Acorn, anybody else, they disappear, those groups. I mean, come on. And then you top it off with that story about the patronage. It's like really going back to pre-progressive, because you know the progressives, their early foray was to challenge just this sort of stuff. I mean, that was like the basis of a lot of their work, is to change up how these governments hand out jobs. You know, it's so interesting that we're
Well, I think that's the overarching point here, is that these thugs in places like Michigan and Maine and Wisconsin and Ohio, and frankly any other place in America where a Republican is in charge, their goal is not to make things better for themselves. These are literally barbarian hordes at the gate of the society that we have heretofore built, right? They intend to tear everything down and remove the foundation stones.
Well, I mean, it's just, I guess what the Republicans are doing in Washington is so over the top that Obama finally had to say, well, no, we can't do this week by week budget shit anymore. I mean, I was surprised they said no. So, I mean, if the government is going to shut down, I hope they have some sort of plan on how to spin it, because he'll get blamed. Although, I have to say, picking that Wasserman Schultz person, that knocked me over. She's actually a pretty good spinner herself. I mean, I was surprised. You heard about this, right?
Yeah. Debbie Wasserman Schultz will be the next DNC chair.
Right, and the thing about her is not only is she progressive, but she's really good at framing shit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. She's of course, if, I mean, just to be fair, the one place, you know, and it's the same way with so many of our good progressive or liberal members of Congress. They're great, 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 and then they lose their minds on Israel. And she's another one of those.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm a grown-up, and I recognize that I don't get a pony.
Right. Well, no, I...
This is a good choice as far as I can tell.
I just assume they're all sort of pro-Israel at this point, Bob. You know what I mean?
Yeah, without a doubt.
But I understand. I'm just saying...
Look, it's somebody who will not sit there and roll over and wait for their either to be kicked or have their tummy scratched,
right,
like Kim Kane.
That's all I mean. I'm not even expecting anything, you know, I mean, I'm not expecting some great propagandist here, but just somebody who can, you know, hold her own. And what, from what I can tell, she's a progressive that seems to be pretty articulate. Anyway, I was, you know, it's just sort of the sort of drunk, just the nonstop mixed messages from this administration is kind of head twirling.
Well, let's back up for a minute. You said if the government shuts down, of course, he's going to be blamed. And I guess that's what the Republicans are counting on, because you know what? They're kind of gleeful about things.
Well, no, I say that he will get blamed, but on the other, I'm sort of thinking if he's really stupid, because there's no way the way that they've been going, because they're not that popular right now, the Congress, as usual. So I think that they, you know, their internal polling, I don't know what's going on, but I think they're about to overreach again. And, you know, they may be gleeful about it. They may want to have something knock out that Ryan's budget out of the news, because that ain't winning them no prizes. Have you seen that thing?
Oh, yeah, it's disgusting.
It's like, are you kidding me? And if anyone pays attention to that... You know, that's an outrage. They want to lower the top tax rate to 25%.
And wipe out the Affordable Care Act and replace Medicare with vouchers.
I mean, it's just like...
Well, no, this, Sandra, this goes back to what I said a couple of minutes ago. This is not tweaking. This is not modifying. This is tearing everything that working people have gained over the course of the last 100 years down to the ground, digging out the footers, and just leaving scorched earth in its place.
And when the problem that I have is, you know, what we have to respond to it is, you know, Obama, which is really scary, because he'll just sort of negotiate it. You know what I'm saying? It's not like he doesn't seem to recognize what is at stake. You see what I'm saying? The way he behaves, he doesn't seem to recognize that, hello, they're trying to wipe out the safety net. And is he really a president that want to be on watch when the whole New Deal is destroyed? I'm just asking, just as from a legacy perspective. You know, I'm curious.
Well, I mean, I know how I, this is, you know, this is the fantasy portion of the program, I guess. I know how I'd handle this. You remember when he appeared at Soldier Field or whatever park in Chicago, and they had and he accepted the nomination in Denver at Mile High Stadium. Remember that?
Yeah.
Well, if the Republicans insist on shutting the government down, I would start booking those stadiums. I'd start booking every stadium in every state of the union that I could find, and I would show up and say, "Tell me, just with your voices, do you want Medicare undone? Do you want Medicaid destroyed? Do you want your roads to go from paved to gravel? If you want that, tell me. But otherwise, you tell them, and just get 70 or 80,000 people at a pop screaming their fool heads off and scare the repiglickins right down to their shoelaces."
Well, no, but see, unfortunately, you know, we don't have. I mean, from what I can tell so far, that is not who he is. He seems to be more in tune with being a compromiser in chief, except when he's not, like bombing brown people, but that's another story. So if 100,000 people in Madison didn't move him to embrace the base, shutting down the government, I guess, won't either. I mean, I don't really know. I'm just sort of reaching out here in the dark because I'm kind of flabbergasted that the Republicans think that this is a good idea, and the reason why they think it's a good idea is because of the weak-ass Democrats. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, because nobody's out there counter-messaging.
Well,
I mean,
otherwise, no one in their right mind would be doing this. And I'm wondering, the bond vigilantes, I'm trying to figure out whose interest is this in? Because it's a huge problem.
Well, I mean, if taxes are going to go down to 25% for the top rate, doesn't that question rather answer itself?
Well, no, but I mean, I don't think that, you know, if Obama's going to, I mean, it looks like the shutdown is going to happen. So when the government shuts down, it's going to be reopened after what? Obama says uncle and gives them everything? I mean,
well, I mean, isn't that, that's the general way that it's worked out so far, isn't it?
Right, so, but do you see how extreme this has gotten? Remember when he agreed and capitulated to the tax cuts?
Yes.
All they had to do was say, we're not going to provide unemployment insurance. Now they're saying, we're going to shut down the government. I mean, it's so predictable on that level, but he's just now saying no, and what is he saying no to? I just heard that, I don't know who's representing the talks, if it's Reid or the senator from New York, what is his name?
Schumer?
Schumer, and he just said, well, there's $33 billion in cuts just for the taking. I mean, the whole thing is framed not as a revenue problem, first off, but as a spending problem, which is the whole Republican frame is being embraced by the Democrats. They're saying, oh, well, we're going to give you 33. Can you accept that? And I'm like, where is the representation for the Democrat base? I don't mean us. I'm just talking about in general. I mean, where's the job plan? Look at England. The cutting is not working for them, and it's not going to work for us. It's just like the whole thing in Washington is just bizarre, except for the fact that their economy there is just going like gangbusters. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So maybe that's what it's all about, because there is no impact on the greater Washington area. So they feel they can behave this way. I don't know, but...
Well, I got to tell you, last night I downloaded to the Kindle... I downloaded to the Kindle Joe Bajan's latest book.
Oh, okay.
Rainbow Pie. I felt like it almost felt like a moral necessity. And as a function of that, while I was watching the roof drip on Agnes and fighting with her about that, move, honey, no... I ran across a passage where he referred to that great mass of Americans who have never been represented in their government and never will. And, you know, that's just a little dose of medicine that, I don't know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe you're not ready for. I mean, I know that and you know that, Sandra, but to see it put in black and white print in front of your face, then suddenly you realize where this stuff comes from. You know, they do. They live in a bubble, whether it be Obama or the Republicans or generally Washington, D.C. It's a bubble. For the crowd that makes in excess of $100,000 a year, it's a bubble. And they don't, realities like the difference between a dinner of beans and cornbread and a dinner of beans, cornbread, and hamburger, it doesn't impact them. Their brains don't work that way, so necessarily they see their budget problems, like you said, as a function of cuts, as a spending problem and not a revenue problem, because they don't really see a revenue problem, because their checks are still clearing.
Right, but I mean, budget, it doesn't mean, I don't know, there's two sides, you know what I mean? I'm just saying it's just completely out of the reality, and kind of what I was trying to say yesterday, but I couldn't because I had to go, was the whole idea that, you know, we're just sort of living in a fantasy world, thinking that we can have any effect whatsoever on the government as it's currently constituted. And I say that, you know, with a lot of apprehension, because, I mean, I wouldn't have studied government if I wasn't, a buyer of what it was selling. You understand what I'm saying?
Right. It's not something to which you come easily.
Right. And so to keep coming, you know, coming to come to this realization about the state of things is a problem for me. I'm just like, and having some sort of insight and understanding about it just makes it even more disturbing, because the politicking still goes on, i.e. this fool going to announce his re-election without even being in his video. It's just hilarious.
Well, let me ask this, because of all the talk about government shutdowns that we see, Sandra, we don't see a whole lot of real-world discussion of what a government shutdown means.
Well, exactly.
Does that mean Social Security checks don't go out? Does that mean government workers don't get paid? What about John Boehner's paycheck? Does he still get his? Does the president get his? What happens with the federal workers since this is the first anniversary of the Upper Big Branch disaster, what happens to federal mine inspectors? Since this is the month when we had the BP the BP disaster, what happens to the people who are supposed to inspect drilling rigs?
Yeah, and how do you, as an executive branch, continue to execute these various wars in the face of a government shutdown, even if it is detached from that particular event? You see what I'm saying? The optics are just hideous for the Congress and for Obama to be doing this now. The fact that they couldn't come to some understanding for the middle voter, which is what everyone's, the vaunted middle, it's so hideous. I don't even know where to start. And I don't know how many days, but a lot of services will be altered in this little exercise. This ain't no joke, as far as I can tell. A lot of things will kind of come to a grinding halt, right?
Well, that's my understanding. Now, but see, this also has a flavor of prelude to it. It feels, I mean, when I think about it, it feels really gut level. But you know that the clock is still ticking on a far more significant date, and that is the issue of raising the debt ceiling. And what these clowns are doing, these dangerous clowns, is on the Republican side, they are preparing America for that, for refusing to raise the debt ceiling.
Right, but I mean, there'd be other interests involved with that one, though. Interests that the Republicans need to placate. You know, I go back now to the debt holders and the global economy. I'm sorry, it's all interconnected now. So I don't know. I'm really having a hard time imagining that event will happen.
But I realize that, Sandra, and I do too. If we were dealing with a circumstance in which you could use the word sane in the same sentence, we're not. I mean, they've campaigned on. I mean, this goes back a ways. Okay, this goes back to W's presidency when he talked about that file cabinet with a bunch of worthless pieces of paper in it, a bunch of worthless IOUs. Now what he was talking about was the Bureau of the Public Debt in Parkersburg, West Virginia. And what he was talking about was the debt. And he referred to it back then, some 6, 7, 8 years ago, as a file cabinet full of worthless IOUs. That idea is perhaps more deeply entrenched in Emery and Eileen's mindset than perhaps we know.
Oh no, it has to be. I know exactly. That whole song and dance. I know, it's just so disturbing. I mean, so you're suggesting that this is an event that they relish, because what is the outcome for them if they don't raise the debt ceiling? I mean, what are they hoping will happen?
I don't know that they know.
They only
know, Sandra, that they have a gang of teabaggers, and see, you know, this is where riding tigers becomes kind of dangerous, because all you can do is sort of grab the ears and hang on. But they know that they've got the teabaggers out there, and the teabaggers are pissed, and they're having, you know, that I mentioned last night, I think it was, that there was a march on. A march in D.C. that featured 2,000 people marching to the headquarters of Koch Industries, but there was no media coverage of it.
Yeah, but that was a lot of people, though.
Oh, it was a bunch of people. But by the same token, you've got these teabaggers who rallied a couple of weeks ago and got media coverage just all over the place, and. Michelle Bachman showed up. You know, the
yeah, but the numbers are just dwindling.
The meme that they've gotten across, if I may, is that refusing to raise the debt ceiling and shutting down the government are somehow patriotic things to do. There was a line in this one story I read from it goes back to March the 30th. From the Christian Science Monitor, and you know, there's something about whenever I see genderized insults, whenever I see sexualized deprecation, my hackles kind of come up. Well, it's kind of like that word we talked about the other night. That's just, you know, no, you don't use that word. Well, in this story from the Christian Science Monitor, you've got a bunch of teabaggers screaming their fool little empty heads off, talking to the crowd, and Kathy Durr, what a great last name, Durr. Kathy Durr, D-I-R-R, of Tea Party Patriots, was screaming, "I say to the Republican leadership, take off your lace panties. Stop being noodlebacks. Take a strong, bold, unwavering stand for and with the American people." And by that, they mean cut the government to the bone, and if they can't do it, shut it down. They're out there at the little Tea Party meetings, Sandra, screaming, "Shut her down."
Well, I mean, if Obama wants to go into his reelection, you know, with a double dip recession, you know what I'm saying? Because all this is not going to bode well for the health of the economy. I just am sort of stunned and just stupefied at that, because the recovery is pretty weak.
It's tottering, to say the least, is it not?
And the housing market is already in a double dip, if you follow the various indices. So this could just sort of tip it over. I don't know. It just seems to be total madness. But listen, I have to tell you this other thing that I, you know how we were talking about the PAGs, those PAG things?
Yeah.
Well, apparently these internal documents, this quote that I found from this PEER, which is the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, they said that the internal documents show that under the updated PAG, a single glass of water could give a lifetime permissible exposure. In addition, it would allow long-term cleanup limits 1,000 times more lax than anything EPA has ever before accepted. These new limits would cause a cancer in as much as every fourth person exposed.
Jesus God.
Right, no. I'm like, and in the meantime, we're being told that we have to accept the Pacific Ocean being polluted because they need to quarantine even more radiated liquids. I'm just like, they're trying, you know, it's just, you know, the Pacific Ocean. I mean, they just think the ocean will dilute anything, huh? The poor ocean.
Well, it's real big.
And not only that, but we're not talking about iodine 31.
No.
We're talking about cesium-137 with a half-life of 30 years, which means that it will go into the upper food chain. That's us, party people. And so I'm just sort of freaking out. I'm thinking,
I'll pass on the sashimi. Yeah.
It's just kind of like.
And the thing is, let's remember, Sandra, we are not putting this into an ecosystem that is otherwise healthy.
Well, exactly. I mean, the oceans are in such disarray and in bad shape anyway. But this sort of talk just a few months ago, you know, would have been just mind numbing. Even venting. Remember when they were venting when this disaster first started? Venting. The air would have been enough to send up alarms a few months ago. But now we're in this new paradigm of acceptable radiation, Bob. And I just cannot wrap my head around it. And I'm so sick of listening to these people say it's all acceptable. And you look at their credentials. Am I going to believe someone like Helen Caldicott or these freaks on the corporate network? You see what I'm saying?
Oh, well, absolutely.
What's
you know,
she
you,
lying
you,
about?
You take,
why would she lie? You see what I'm saying? And these other people.
Why would she lie? But if we go back to Chris's call last night, it's and this may be after you had headed off to your function. Chris was talking about the fact that it may not necessarily be lying. It's just don't know and are repeating what is told to them. Whereas, you know, the other part of Chris's call is that. You know, you take these things that start out as radioactive this or radioactive that, but then you're in a, but then you get into a cycle where the damn things break down into these toxic ass heavy metals that are not that you know, and you thought you had problems with the radiation, you know?
Oh no, and then they start turning into other things.
Right.
That's another thing I've been reading about, I'm just like, you know, you get these new chlorines and new creations of isotopes that weren't there before, but when they interact, it's just hideous. All of it is really astounding, and it is just not getting the sort of attention that it should be, and I'm so freaked out by the sheer amount of radioactive material that they seem to just be unleashing, and there's no end in sight. And what? Everything just goes on as normal? I'm just confused. I am, like, really? I'm just disturbed by it.
Well, you know, I think I said a week or so ago that a part of the strategy on this, I would suspect, is that, you know, one of the things radiation does is it causes cancer. And one of the things that cancers do is they grow either aggressively or slowly. So that if 30 years from now we've got a big cancer problem, well, you know, who knows if that was caused by the Fukushima disaster.
Well, yeah, that's the trump card that the whole industry has. And at the same time, they also seem to be in collusion with the IAEA?
Yeah.
and the World Health Organization, because they're still trying to say that only 35 people died at Chernobyl. Please.
Yeah, when the numbers are, what, nearly six, what, five digits? Six?
Well, it's almost a million if you go by the New York Academy of Sciences. That's not some cheesy-ass organization. They apparently were able to translate Russian peer review papers for the first time, and it all shows upward of a million people have died because of Chernobyl. So, what's going on with the UN organizations?
You know, I don't know.
And you have to be concerned.
And yet, at the same time, that same UN is putting out these bulletins that you and I have discussed about Cote d'Ivoire. Maybe the scope is just too big for the UN, or because Japan is not a poor and impoverished debtor nation, that there are things that can't be said.
Yeah, but they're heading that way, though. See, the reality, the information can be managed within an inch of our lives, but they got readings that are so high they don't even have instruments to read it anymore. Did you hear about this?
Yeah, you know, where the thing pegs out and just answer hazy, ask again later?
Oh. Right, so it's so high that the workers, first of all, can't go near any of these buildings right now because they don't even know what the reading is. Greenpeace keeps going further and further and further away, and they get hideous readings. Greenpeace, which is, you know, quote, independent.
Right.
So they can't hide it unless they do an EPA and make the instruments disappear.
Well, that's next, isn't it?
Which is what they've been doing out here. Anyway, listen, I know I'm borderline hysterical with this issue, but I can't tear myself away from it.
Well, no, I don't think you're borderline hysterical. I think you're probably your response is probably the sanest. I mean, as compared to the grinning bobbleheads on TV, we need a few people screaming from the rooftops.
Well, this just sort of takes me back. So I told you that I went to a talk. I was in a room with like about only ten people who decided they'd come and hear Helen Caldicott speak. And I'm just like, oh dear God, because she spoke for about an hour, right? And she's hella wry and like, oh, you know, I got a little bit of heart disease. I ain't gonna be around forever. You know, you people need to get it together. I mean, she's great. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
She just tells shit like it is.
And I expect something similar this Saturday night when Chris Hedges comes to South Charleston, West Virginia. Like I said, we'll hopefully be broadcasting it here on the Horn. I've been reading a bunch of his stuff lately, and you know what? He's not in a good mood.
I don't know that dude. No, listen, I am also a fan, although he seems to be shifting to more of a doing and reporting now. Like, he's like, right, okay, this is what's going on. I've been writing about it for the last whatever. And now he seems to be, you know, participating in...
Well, he's going to be participating in, I guess, some civil disobedience in New York City, April the 15th at Bank of America. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's also, you know, he was arrested, pretty sure. He was arrested at that event that I was at in D.C. a couple of weeks ago.
Right. Well, so these people, him and, like, that Caldicott, I mean, these people, they don't really, what's their agenda? I mean, you can be saying, the most cynical thing I can say is, oh, maybe they want to sell some books. But that's way less than trying to control the information to promote your poison and toxin and horrible...
Well, yeah, and reading, you know, reading Chris Hedges right now, Sandra, I get the idea that his agenda is actually trying to keep full-on civilization collapse from transpiring.
No, that's what I mean. And I'm just sort of saying, when I say, well, what do these people have to lose? People who are sort of shouting what is going down at this point. You see what I mean? So, you know, I'm trending towards anyone who's not associated with some death industry. I don't know if you've seen the latest ad from BP in the Gulf. Got some restaurateurs talking about, oh, business is great, and they're serving seafood, and BP did such a wonderful job, and it's just like...
Yeah, see, that doesn't have any effect on me, though, because I heard Dar Jamal.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Me too.
I mean,
also, you know, looking at the, I've read a few different scientists who have been sort of, you know, doing activist work down there in the form of helping testing people and helping communities deal with the level of toxicity, and it's not right down there.
Oh, not by a long shot.
And I heard
no, hell no.
And I heard that Obama administration today have gagged the release of how many dolphins have died.
It's massive.
Under the idea that, well, we don't want to let that information out because it's, you know, it's still in process of being investigated.
Right, because that's we don't fully understand just how poisoned they are.
That's BS. They don't want that number out. They don't want it out.
Well, like because dolphins, you know, there's something about a dolphin that even for people who deny evolution, you know, those people, there's something about a dolphin that touches us, that we, for some reason or another, we recognize ourselves in the eyes of that dolphin.
Well, they got mutated ones showing up. And
oh, yeah, dolphins with babies' arms growing out of their heads, yeah.
Miscarried, you know, they're talking about that rate is off the charts, and the fact that the government is hiding it, I mean, you just have to shake your head. But back to the people, though, the sort of all these people who are sick down there, though.
Yeah, it's one of the people that Dar Jamal referenced is a guy named Dr. Ray, and I've been trying to get him on the program, and I hope to in the near future just
is
to talk. Yeah, he's one of the people who treats. He went in there and looked and said, "Oh yeah, this is toxic exposure," and he's rather an expert on the subject. Here we are. It's April. It's anniversary time for the BP disaster and the Upper Big Branch disaster. You know, Don Blankenship's not behind bars.
Well, he's what, living a good life now, ain't he?
Oh hell yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you know, but then again, Don Blankenship is trash. For him, the good life is two happy meals a day instead of one that he gets to throw at his maid.
Would you know somebody else you might want to look into possibly getting? Is that Wilma Subra? Have you heard of her?
No.
Okay, well, it's spelled W-I-L-M-A Subra, S-U-B-R-A. She's an environmentalist / chemist who is out of Louisiana, you know, been testing and helping communities for years. But I heard her interviewed recently, and I mean, it's just so.
And that, you know, that's a big part of it, Sandra. We've got to counter the BS.
Yeah, I'm just saying, she's, you know, it might be somebody you can get on, you know, because she had a lot of information.
Yeah. And, you know, David in Tennessee just told me, based on all the radiation stuff we were talking about, he said, the part of the U.S. that's really nervous is Portland, Oregon. Because, you know, that radiation can and does travel, and it's not all going to drop in the ocean, and that wouldn't even be good in the first place. But David notes that Portland, Oregon draws its water from an impoundment 25 miles east of downtown out toward Mount Hood. And he says the source is so clean, the drinking water for PDX requires only settling ponds for leaf bits and pine needles.
So they don't have a whole processing like most of us.
Yeah, he said that 100-plus acre lake is sitting there open to the rainfall. If that radiation leaves Japan as airborne moisture and falls into Bull Run Reservoir, Portland is looking at glowing water. 1.5 million people looking for drinking water. And David says, that ain't funny, McGee. And it ain't.
Well, and I just, you know, I don't know. I'm really, yeah. So this is, and we were just talking about BP, which is horrific. But that radiation stuff, though, is off the charts as far as just how horrible it could be. And I don't need to hear about the EPA wanting to allow the public to drink water that you're playing Russian roulette with now. God damn, that's disturbing.
And, well, like I said, I think it comes down to there's a reality that's hiding behind all of this, Sandra, and that is those folks are as clueless as we are. And the only thing that they could say that would actually be true is, folks, cue up Porky Pig.
Well, you
we're
know,
screwed.
I just want to know who in the EPA agency is, you know, agitating for this to happen. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's just like, it just seems so beyond the beyond that's their response.
But remember also the conversation we had about the nature of the American people. We're not going to stand patiently in line waiting for our whatever it is we need. We're not going to do what the Japanese people have done. We're going to run screaming in the streets and start shooting zombies.
That's not me to laugh, but I know every time I think about, you know, what would be going on here if that had to happen here, I just shake my head because...
Well, but that's the thing. It's going to happen here. As I think you sort of inexorably point out, it's coming. It's not stationary. It's not immobile.
Right, but see... I'm here in California, though.
Right. Yeah, I get that.
Oh, God. So, you know.
And so when the American people start screaming and hunting zombies, they're going to start screaming and hunting zombies in California, Oregon, and Washington first. And then the zombie apocalypse will move from west to east.
Well, I just saw some sort of report that, you know, the leak has slowed. You know, via TEPCO. I don't believe, you know, I'm not trusting it.
Yeah, sorry, no.
You know, I don't know.
No, as far as I'm concerned, you know, like I said, they've moved into the junk shot phase of all of this, and the top hat and the top cat. And
they're trying to say that junk shot has slowed it. And I'm just like, oh, please, are you kidding me? But
see, where this kind of radioactive horror is concerned, slowing it is the difference between hitting a wall at 100 miles an hour and hitting a wall at 90.
Yeah.
You know, slowing it doesn't matter. There are only two things that matter. It's going, and we stopped it.
No, but I'm still stuck on the whole idea of the measurement instruments not even being able to measure anything anymore because it's so high.
You know, and what you do is this is a design failure. When it gets off the charts like that, the LED display needs to simply say, oh, hell.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's, you know, and it's just, and I guess another thing that's really getting to me is this started, when did these four people have this horrible tragedy on the 11th? So we're starting to approach the 30-day point.
Right.
And we're also getting news of poor people being shunned. Oh, you might be radiated.
Yeah, you can't live in the shelter. You're glowing.
Oh, God. And I'm thinking, oh, no. You know.
Yeah, so they're just sort of cast into the wild.
Right. And also, yeah, so it's just, you know, the poor Japanese, I haven't really forgotten what those poor people are being put through. And they can't, you know... Are they making plans to sort of rope off a good chunk of it? Or what's going on?
For a long, long time. Well, you know, they've got a no entry zone out in the ocean too, but nobody's telling the fish.
What about the? I'm just thinking about all the chain of sort of transfer, you know, in the sea with the life and the food chain. I mean, that is like at the heart of everything in the ecosystem.
It's life on the planet.
Oh, God. You know, and it's just, all I have to say to people out there, you guys all need to bone up on some science. Good Lord.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, the Fancy Free just shot a note toward me, to me, Sandra, and she reminds me of something. We, you know, we in this country have a history of radioactive denial. Because Fancy said, you know, the military personnel who were marched out to observe the atom bomb tests in New Mexico were exposed to what the government called acceptable late levels of radiation. And as Fancy notes, acceptable to whom?
Yeah.
So, you know, this denial is a river that runs deep.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also really concerned for, you know, all the sort of fetuses. I mean, if you're pregnant, it's a problem. It really is. It's
yeah, well,
a bad time to be pregnant.
Right, and we're, but we're not going to have that conversation. We're not going to ask those questions. We're not going to ask the pro-life movement, gosh, how do you feel about... how do you feel about carrying babies to term that have been hopelessly radiated?
I mean, just there's so many questions. If you just look at the whole radiation thing from a medical, you know, perspective, like ingesting, that's where I'm at. I'm like, forget the outside. How about all this shit that's being inhaled and ingested, you know?
And remember, it was our buddy David in South Carolina who sent the story along from the state or whatever the name is. That the register, the little meters there that still can measure this stuff are going clickety, 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 clickety. And the first thing is that, well, this is obviously not from our nuclear plants, okay? Everything's just fine. No, everything's not just fine because that's obviously radiation from freaking Japan.
Right. It's the same thing in Berkeley. It's like, oh, dear. It's 181 times what's acceptable in the rainwater on their measurements at UC Berkeley. So, and Davis, which is like a throw stone from my damn house. So, yeah, no, I'm, you know, I'm on the front line. Except I'm not, because I'm not in Japan. But you know what I'm saying?
Right, and you're not okay. It's not okay.
It's not okay.
But,
anyway.
but you know, that's something that the for-profit media hasn't figured out yet, that there are a lot of people out there going, it ain't okay.
Well, listen, I have to ask you, have you heard anything about, and this is totally outside of what we're talking about, but the election in Wisconsin, I mean, I have to shift to that.
I haven't seen a result. Okay. You know, they're in central time, so their polls are still open.
Okay.
I would imagine their polls, and a Wisconsin person can tell me otherwise, I would imagine their polls will be open probably for another hour.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, you know, that's kind of important, you know, to see how that works out. Because I was hearing that woman ran a... is running a hideous campaign. She doesn't know what to do politically, so it would be more amazing if she...
Yeah, and the only Democrat on that ballot.
That's bizarre. But I suppose this, they weren't thinking about this, you know, when this whole election started, obviously.
No. No, it wasn't in the cards.
Right. So anyway, okay, well, you know.
So you know what the messaging will be if she loses. Well, see, this doesn't matter in Wisconsin. Because voters overwhelmingly approved a Republican judge who is a close ally of Governor Scott Walker.
No. It's really, and that's what I'm saying, it's really, it would be really a big bump if he lost. Okay.
Yeah, because this is a referendum on him.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. But anyway, at this point, you know, I guess I don't have anything else.
All right, Sandra. You know, just sort of hang tight, you know, the hang tight and vent nightly.
Yes. Oh,
all right.
God. Okay.
Later. Bye now. Sandra calling from California. And, you know, we make light and we joke and we carry a kid and carry on. But, yeah, this stuff goes to... It, when it's showing up in South Carolina, it's... Well, you heard her talking about the numbers at Berkeley and Davis. Those are not inspiring numbers. And what David said about the reservoir near Portland. There's stuff on the line here. And underneath, undergirding all of this is one thing. This is, you know, we had that line back during the Cold War that there's no such thing as being able to win a nuclear war. We never quite got around to extending that to nuclear power. But there's no way to have an acceptable meltdown. There's no such thing as a small meltdown. Meltdowns are human disasters, environmental disasters. And characterizing them as anything but that is the height of irresponsibility. People need to be being told how to, if it is even possible, guard and protect themselves against this stuff. Jesus Christ! You remember after September 11th, when they told us to run out and buy effing duct tape and plastic sheeting and put it over our windows in case Saddam came after us? Well, now we need some real-world instructions along those lines. But you know what? Your government is not going to provide those, because your government right now is knee-deep in absolutely watered-bowel fear for what happens if the American people panic. And yes, we panic. Take one good long look at Katrina, and you know we panic. And we die. And it's frightening. Just plain frightening. So I don't begrudge Sandra her misgivings. And, you know, she says, I guess I'm getting a little hysterical and things like that. She said that more than once. But I don't think so. God damn, the one thing in the world you can do if you have any power is to try to arm yourself with knowledge, with information, with understanding, so that hopefully, if there's something you can do, you're in a position to do it. You know, Jesus, if it's only head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Martians, you can do that. But there's no such thing as a safe nuclear disaster. It will touch everyone. It's like how we manage to have global climate catastrophe deniers is beyond me. When we know what happens just in the natural world, think about what happened to the planet after the explosion of Krakatoa that effed up the planet for 5-10 years? Yeah. You know, I've got a cartoon here was sent to me on my Facebook page. It's from the Bors blog, BORSBLOG, Matt Bors, MATTBORS.com. And it's a four-panel cartoon called Meltdown. And this is in no wise to diminish the significance of the disaster at Fukushima. It is more in the way of pointing out the fact that we are in a position where we can't tolerate any more disasters. Like I said, it's a four-panel drawing by Matt Bors. It's a wide-eyed, blonde-haired, panicking news anchor screaming, "Crisis! Catastrophe! Toxic plumes from an energy plant threaten an entire region. Exposure will cause cancer and birth defects. The land contaminated for generations. Tens of thousands could die." You know, with pictures of people with masks over their faces and crying babies. And our correspondent is near the leak. "Amy, what are officials doing to evacuate the area?" And the shot around Amy widens and she says, "Nothing, Mark. It's a coal plant in Appalachia. Back to you." And that's the truth. That's reality. And I really do, and if somebody can show me that I'm not, that I've missed it somehow, I need to know. But just as I said with the BP disaster, I say now, the big greens, and you know who they are, Sierra Club, Natural Resources Defense Council, others, need to be standing on their respective rooftops screaming their fool heads off that all of these things are toxic. That a nuclear disaster is not a reason to look more deeply at coal. That an oil spill in the Gulf is not a reason to look more favorably upon nuclear. That the only answer that humanity has, And, you know, this is just the straight talk that you and I engage in. The only hope that humanity has, if after Fukushima humanity has any hope, and it's beginning to look like an open question, it's beginning to have a sort of Malthusian flavor about it, you know, that big die-off thing. The only hope that humanity has is to transition as quickly as possible, as quickly as humanly possible. Not that all deliberate speed BS from Brown versus Board of Education. I mean fast as our little hands and little legs will carry us away from hydrocarbons. Forever. No more coal, no more gas, no more nuclear. Okay, that's not a hydrocarbon, but you get the idea. No more oil, no oil shale, no freaking tar sands. Wind, solar, and geothermal. There is enough latent potential energy in the planet to run the planet if we breed ourselves stupid, which we damn near already have. And the worst part of all of it is that we won't. We won't. You'll ask for it. You'll beg for it. We together will call for it. Thousands, tens of thousands of young people in Washington, D.C. in a couple of weeks will scream at the top of their lungs for it at an event called Power Shift. But I come back to that passage from Joe Bajan's book where he talks about the millions and millions of people in this country who have never had and will never have anything resembling responsible or even at all political representation in this country. Even those poor, daggum, dumb little teabaggers. Don't realize that they're not represented either. The only thing represented in this country anymore are corporations. It's pretty simple. I don't like talking this way, but you know what? Reality spoken here. Because what? These lone little 3 hours that we spend together on any given evening, and we're going to bullshit each other? Not I, and nor have you ever done it to me either. Nor, I hope, would we. So the question becomes one of, you know, how we deal with this. How do we arm ourselves, not with firearms, but with knowledge? How do we reach out to help other people who are terrified not to start some sort of godforsaken zombie apocalypse? How do we create community to work with each other and help each other and reach out to each other and take care of each other if the radiation reaches here? Because I am unwilling to accept blindly some statement from my government that says, well, you know what, it's not gonna. We just don't have that to worry about. You know, you think about what we have here and what we have in the world, and I'm reminded of the closing lines spoken by the chorus in Shakespeare's Henry V. Talking about the young Henry VI crowned in the cradle. And he says of it, whose state so many had the managing, that they lost France and made his England bleed. What's the relevance of that? Whose state so many had the managing. Too many cooks spoil the pot. And we are looking at a pot damn nigh not spoiled, but outright poisoned. So it's about 11 minutes before the hour. If you're on hold, please stay that way. We'll come to you right out of the break. It's Tuesday night, so naturally we have the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doy. And Brad's subbing for Mike Malloy this week while Tribe Malloy are on spring break. Bless them. Spring break. Ooh. They'll be back, I guess, Monday night? But Brad's subbing this week and doing a great job of it. But he's also got, he and Desi have the usual Green News Report this evening, which is coming up presently. We'll take a little break and then come back to more of your calls at 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn, and I'm Bob. It's Tuesday, April 5th, 2011.
We are trying to stop the flow, but so far it is not successful.
Running out of ideas, Japan dumps tons of radioactive water into the ocean as their nuclear nightmare continues to continue.
Perhaps accident is the wrong word to characterize what happened in Montcoal, West Virginia last April 5th.
The one-year anniversary of the Upper Big Branch Mine disaster. Guess what's the fastest growing sector of the economy? It's energy related, and it's not coal, oil, or nuclear. Plus, Transocean executives receive safety bonuses less than a year after 11 men died on their rig in the Gulf.
Of course they do. All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Transocean calls 2010, quote, the best year in safety performance in the company's history. The company bases that, apparently, on what it describes as its exemplary statistical safety record as measured by our total recordable incident rate.
You know, that reminds me of one of the worst company Christmas cards I've ever seen. I believe it was, Merry Christmas, Hindenburg Zeppelin Associates. Congratulations on 364 incident-free days of flying.
Yep. This is your Green News Report.
Okay, but you know, that's just crazy.
Okay, Des, already another big green news week. What do you have for us today?
Well, just breaking, both literally and figuratively, as we go to air today, 3 million gallons of untreated sewage have spilled from a container breach at a sewage treatment plant in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, into a nearby river. Two employees are missing, and the officials say they may have been swept away in what one city official called a, quote, catastrophic event.
Was it Tennessee where we saw, just a year or two ago, tons and tons of toxic coal ash waste also spilling into a town and wiping it out?
Yeah, billions of gallons, still haven't cleaned it up. April is the cruelest month, so the poet T.S. Eliot wrote, and this April marks the anniversaries of three major disasters: the Massey Upper Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia, the BP oil disaster in the Gulf, and of course, the Chernobyl nuclear accident in 1979. First, Tuesday, April 5th, marks the one-year anniversary of the explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine in Montcoal, West Virginia, that killed 29 miners, the deadliest mining accident in the U.S. in 40 years. Although the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration has yet to release a final report, investigators believe the explosion at the troubled mine was caused by a buildup of methane and coal dust due to inadequate ventilation and ignited by a spark from aging equipment. Representative Lynn Woolsey, in a speech on the floor of the House of Representatives Tuesday, criticized Massey Energy for its dismal safety record.
This wasn't a hurricane. It wasn't a tsunami or some other act of nature. It is absolutely clear from the preliminary reports that this tragedy was avoidable, but for negligence and carelessness on the part of Massey Energy.
Mine owner Massey Energy disputes those allegations and calls the accident, quote, a natural disaster.
Really? A natural disaster?
According to the chairman of the Massey board. As you heard earlier, it's not even been a full year since the BP oil disaster in the Gulf began with a catastrophic explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon rig, killing 11 men and causing the worst offshore oil spill in the nation's history. But that's been quite long enough for Transocean, the owners of the doomed rig. Showing absolutely no sense of irony, Transocean announced $1 million bonuses for its executive team this week for an exemplary safety record in 2010. After an outcry, Transocean issued a statement acknowledging that calling 2010 their best year for safety ever, quote, may have been insensitive, but did not issue an apology.
May have been. I love in their statement originally to the SEC, they said, notwithstanding the tragic loss of life in the Gulf of Mexico, we achieved an exemplary statistical safety record. Yes, notwithstanding the loss of 11 men, 9 of whom were Transocean workers. Amazing.
On to Japan, where officials are running out of ideas as their nuclear nightmare at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant moves into its fourth week. The operator of the crippled nuclear power plant said on Tuesday, water inside a stricken reactor has tested at 5 million times the legal limit for radioactivity. On Tuesday, Chief Cabinet Minister Yukio Edano announced that over 11,000 tons of radioactive water contaminated with low levels of radiation was released directly into the ocean in order to make room to store more dangerous, highly radioactive water. Multiple attempts to stop an unknown leak of radioactive water from the plant into the sea may have slowed, but have not stopped the leak.
Here we are, 1 year after the BP Gulf disaster, and we are looking at another energy company trying to plug a leak going into the ocean. They tried over the weekend to spray polymer, newspaper, and sawdust onto the crack, and that didn't do the trick. BP junk shot anyone?
But there is one bright spot amidst the ongoing disasters and these disaster anniversaries. The fastest growing sector of the economy in the United States is solar power, currently enjoying 67% growth over last year.
There you go, finding the sunny side of April. Way to go, Des. For more on that and the other stories we didn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. We rely on you to keep telling the truth over your public airwaves. We really do. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Global Genius, it's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second, it's totally my mother's soap.
Global Genius, it's not your father's soap.
No, see, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap, there's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Global Genius, we got your soap right here.
And got your bath and body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
The top of the third hour of the program. Thought I'd run that instead. Thanks, John Fox, for sending it along. Thought I'd run that instead of the hour three intro. This marks the ninth anniversary today, does, of the death of Lane Staley, lead singer for Alice in Chains. Wow, that's powerful. So we've got about 55 minutes or so of conversation radio left in this Tuesday. It's not Wednesday. Don't hurry things along, Bob. This Tuesday edition of the Horn. And I'm sitting here crossing my fingers that it not rain again because, as I mentioned, it rained in the bedroom last night. That sucked a lot. I got to tell you, it did. But as soon as we'll start trying to figure out how to patch the roof as soon as the rain stops. You know, you can't do much roof work in the rain. So... Yeah, hopefully it doesn't rain again tonight. Anyway, a couple of trips a couple of trips into the mailbag here. Kate writing in. It was just hard to believe it was just a year ago that I was at Pipestem State Park when the mine blew up in Gatlinburg. What was that sewage story? I just caught the tail end of it. Yeah, a couple of people missing, a massive sewage containment break in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Oh, they're going to love that. You know, that's tourism central for East Tennessee. There is no place that the pollution merchants don't think is an appropriate, because it, hey, look, you know, so we had a spill, but you know what? In the last quarter, we were able to issue, the profit was involved. Ron and Raleigh writing, he says, going back to the Bristol Palin and the Situation, what a stupid nickname. I heard that Situation pulled down in the neighborhood of 2 million simoleons last year. Kind of makes you sick, don't it? Yeah, nauseatingly so. Hey, welcome to the program.
A little quote to open up the conversation.
Hey, David.
Corruption charges. Corruption. Corruption is government intrusion into market efficiencies in the form of regulation. That's Milton Friedman. He got a goddamn Nobel Prize. We have laws against it precisely so we can get away with it. Corruption is our protection. Corruption keeps us safe and warm. Corruption is why you and I are prancing around in here instead of fighting over scraps of meat out in the street. Corruption is why we win.
Wait, that's all a quote?
Yeah.
Milton Friedman?
No, that's a quote from the movie Syriana.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, actually, I thought it was the first Wall Street movie. Because you know, the spiritual godfather of Gordon Gekko is Milton Friedman. I mean, a lot of people point to Michael Milken and folks like that, but that greed is good business. That all goes home and rests in a basket on Milton Friedman's rotten doorstep.
You can go back to Rockefeller. I mean, it's a universal character to me.
Yeah, it's part of that bunch's genetic makeup, isn't it?
Well, I agree with that, but I think also it's a moral lesson on how we can how we could all become that if we're not careful.
Yeah, under the right set of circumstances, I guess. You just sort of get involved in it. There's not a lot of places, David, where you can't sort of apply there, but for the grace of God goes John Smith.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's another one. But, nah, I don't know. I don't know. Would all of us, if we just were exposed to, you know, Wall Street bonus money, we'd all just turn into instant asshole?
I think what
just
happened,
add hot money?
I'd like to give you an example of something close to that. I was reading on a game blog about how this guy was led into the world of game reviewing and how it works. And he had a meeting with the game development THQ, and this gives you an example of how this happens so fucking fast. No matter how moral you are, no matter how ethical you are, immediately they rush him into a room. And there's a TV on, and it's an ATV game that looks really, really crappy. But he doesn't have the chance to respond because they hand him a controller. Now listen up, people. They hand him a controller, and they immediately have the thing blaring, and everyone around him is constantly talking. They hand him a folder instantly. He has no minute to respond except when they ask him, and they ask him point blank. He goes, isn't this cool? This is just so damn cool. And they're all surrounding him, and he goes, so this is what we want you to do. And I mean, oh, just like that. He didn't even know what to do because he was instantly thrown in that situation. And he said, and as soon as I got out of there, I felt like dirt because the game was a piece of shit. But he knew when he did that review, he had to give him what THQ wanted. So that's on a micro level, that's how it works.
Yeah, it does. But,
I mean, but Bob, what I'm saying is all of us are susceptible to that. That's the problem. When the minute you say you're not susceptible to it, you don't know unless you're into that situation. And that's exactly why I put it out there. Because this guy, because the reviewer, he said, I hated this game. He goes, I knew what I was going to say when I went in there, but the way they fucking set it up, the way they had everybody surrounding him, the way they threw the controller to him, and the way they pointed the screen, and they just sold him on what he had to say. He had no chance to. He just said basically, "Oh yeah, it's kind of awesome because you're thrown in that situation. That's what happens in politics. That's what happens in business." You know, the other thing that was interesting when you were talking about the Dolphin situation, because I always love bringing this up. Why is it that so many environmental organizations pay attention to the fucking dolphin, but they don't pay attention to the shark? You know why it is?
Because the shark's mean.
No, it's that, and it's the fucking lobbyists, and it's the politics behind it.
But the shark. The other thing is that the shark is a fish, and the dolphin is a mammal. You know,
that too. Oh, the other thing is that.
I remember pointing out at the time of the Upper Big Branch disaster and the BP disaster, because they were kind of after a while, sort of dovetailing together.
Mm-hmm.
I remember observing that if only we could find a dead dolphin floating in a sludge impoundment in West Virginia, maybe the rest of the country would pay attention.
Well, you know, the thing about it was an interesting documentary I mentioned on the program before about the world of the contempt for the sharks. That's what the documentary was. Why do we have such fucking hatred from sharks, and where did it start with? And it goes back to, you know, the Steven Spielberg and Jaws and a lot of the people who have their own myths that they applied to sharks. And, I mean, the documentary, they explain in depth about why the sharks are ignored, and it's just like you want to hit your head against the wall. And I'm telling people this because these people who constantly talk about dolphins, they're fucking frauds if they don't talk about the plight of the sharks. I'm sorry, but that's the truth.
Because the whole, it boils down to, David, is the whole ocean is a plight zone.
Right, right.
We talk about what the radiation will do in the ocean, and that's why in the course of that conversation with Sandra, I couldn't help pointing out that, yeah, it's not like this is happening to an otherwise okay ocean system, because the ocean is freaking toxic. We have continent-sized zones that are just nothing but old beer can plastic things and plastic bags and dead zones in bays and you get the point. And you know God help me, I love rare tuna, tuna sushi, sashimi. You know, because it's almost like eating raw, rare red meat, because it is red meat. But you know what? If you just ate that every day,
mm-hmm.
you'd be madder than the Hatter from Alice Through the Looking Glass in a couple of months. Because it's just a big old dose of mercury. And you know, freshwater fish is not immune, because the rain it falleth upon every one, as the playwright said. And consequently, every one of those little raindrops has some mercury in it. And it doesn't matter where on the planet it falls. Where it falls, it drops some mercury. Ugh, you know.
Wow, you just phased out on me there for a minute.
Sorry.
Again, it's the CIA.
I sat down as I was driving home from Mississippi.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the South, and there's two things you can get in the South that I'm just not going to get when I'm back here.
Mm-hmm.
It's good barbecue and good catfish.
Mm.
So I got my good barbecue, and on the way home, there's catfish joints. So for lunch, I stopped at a little catfish joint, and I had my fill, and it was wonderful. It was just what the doctor ordered at about noon. But I'm sitting there eating it, thinking, you know, because the menu says pond-raised, farmed catfish, and because that's supposed to be a selling point, because it isn't eating off the bottom of some, you know, toxified river somewhere. But guess what? That farm-raised catfish is as bad as toxic as anything swimming in any river, David, because it's because the rain rains on the ponds. And the rain is chock full of mercury. And the rain's chock full of mercury because we insist on burning coal. You know, we got nuclear spills. We got an anniversary of a mine disaster. We got an anniversary of an oil disaster coming up. Curiously, left out of all of that mix is the anniversary of a solar panel disaster or a wind turbine disaster. Because they don't happen.
Well, you know, the thing is I think we just like playing with not just one Pandora boxes. We want to juggle them. if you really look
God,
at it.
God, you know what? That's the toaster comment tonight.
That's
humanity juggling Pandora's boxes with the hinges loose.
That you know what? That would be a great app. That would be a great app. I think a lot of people would have fun playing that game. You look at what's happening in the world. Just to give you an example of what's happening, you know, Cuba just got the pass for 5 oil wells in the Gulf. 5 oil wells? Wow. I mean, let's just give all the countries all the oil wells. Since the United States is, we've basically shown the world. We've said, hey, look, we're going to continue drilling oil wells. Everyone else, it's safe. We got it under control with the junk shot. And, of course, the thing that happened in Japan, the Bounty Quicker Picker-Upper with the absorbent material.
You went there, too? Because that was the first... Oh, it's the Quicker Picker-Upper. Jesus, I wonder if the Koch brothers have made some money out of this now.
They probably have. You know, that's here's the funny thing about where people are talking about radiation. And they say, why are people... It says, why are these companies and corporations not scared? Because they're going to make money on the cleanup. For God's sakes, they're going to make money on the anti-radiation.
Yeah, and there's an accountant out there somewhere saying, you know what, we can probably increase the share price by a quarter of a penny.
Isn't it funny how all of the scare and the fear tactics of everything with socialism, anything with the environment, Just everything tying together, it's all out in force, and what they give us for an alternative is complete and utter poison. it's not a coincidence.
No.
It's designed.
Yeah, this is not a boating accident, to go back to your shark analogy.
Yeah, it's not a boating accident.
Hey, I got to ask you, David, because it didn't happen last week. You put out 2 teases about the Steely Dan thing. I must know.
Oh. All right. Well,
you can't just hang that out there and then walk away from it.
So I was listening to I listen to quite a bit of music, and when I listen to music, I usually listen to collections. And a few years back, I got into a gospel group called Take Six. And Take Six is really amazing with harmonies and a cappellas, and they're really good for their interpretations for music. And I was listening, and I heard this I'm looking for the particular song lyrics right now so I can cue it up. But I was listening to the song, and I was saying, huh, they were doing a bunch of covers, and I was like, these are some interesting covers, and I like how they do harmonies. They're kind of like the Manhattan Transfer of gospel. And
Operator. Yeah, okay, yeah. That's all the singing for tonight.
So they have this album titled Beautiful World, and I realized that I looked in the backgrounds, they were interested in Donald Fagen and Steely Dan, and they did a lot of covers like Michael McDonald, Sting's Fragile. But the one thing I noticed... I'm not making this up.
Oh, dear.
One thing I noticed is they did a cover of Beautiful World, but they rewrote the lyrics. And I was like, what was the point of rewriting the lyrics?
You mean, what a beautiful world this will be, what a glorious time to be free?
But they wrote it like this, Bob. And I remember I was listening, I think it was the first time I listened, like 7 years ago. I was like, I didn't even pay attention to these lyrics. But now that it's like a crystal clarity moment, like, these aren't the lyrics. But anyways, these were the lyrics. I look around and I see heartache and disaster, a strange calamity. I wonder how it's going to be. Will it end in some spectacle? Goractacality. One must consider what one believes, evolution or creation. I choose to believe in God. So the end is not a period, but a pause. I'm like, that's not the lyrics. And I wonder if Donald Fagen and Walter Becker know about this. And they're like, whoa,
I just feel all nasty now.
I know. And the thing is that here's the thing about it that's really, really, you know, creepy, is all of the songs are originally done with all the lyrics and stuff, but it's like they had the gall to say, you know what, since we can't get Steely Dan to work with us, that's what I'm thinking anyways. Let's just
screw up the song.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I thought to myself, I thought, why would you change the lyrics? Because, I mean, the lyrics were perfect as is. And I thought, you know, this is a bigger problem that we have in this country, than anything, is this whole, Christian influence on everything. If someone is afraid of a thought or an idea or a concept that is kind of foreign to the dogma of Christianity.
And, you know, absolutely, and this is a good place for me to mention again.
Yeah.
The worthwhile qualities of going ahead. I was tickled to find out that Joe Bajant's book, Rainbow Pie, is available for Kindle. So it's interesting you mention that, because he addresses this very thing inside the book, how it is that you take a mass of people and deliberately keep them ignorant so that you can get away with selling them snake oil like creationism.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how everyone is how anyone or anyone that you think that wouldn't engage. I didn't think they would. That's part of the problem I have with a lot of the Christian industry, and I just wonder. I think what would the reaction be if someone took one of their spiritual hymns and rewrote it into something being lewd? Like,
well, no, I can tell you, because they don't like it worth a damn when I sing Swing Low Sweet Cadillac instead of Swing Low Sweet Chariot. They don't like that.
I can imagine, and it's just a I don't know. It was just something that struck me as humorous, that the one song and the title of the album, and I just kept thinking to myself, Becker and Fagen have to know about this.
Yeah, because that's I was just checking. That's I guess the formal title is IGY.
Yeah.
Because it's named after the International Geophysical Year.
And here's another lyric that it's so blatant. That's the other thing. They said I won the streets of gold, never a goodbye, and never ever growing old. They said with my own eyes I'd see the one who God will make it all actuality. I mean, really? You threw out the whole song except the chorus?
Wait, they kept "What a Beautiful World It."
Yeah,
they kept that?
They kept that.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry, David. We got to do this. Hang on.
Yeah.
This is just sort of a cleanse.
Yeah, okay.
Hang on, well, I'm going to move it forward just a hair, because there's a whole bunch of the intro. They better be paying royalties if they. Oh my God!
I would hope they would. And you know the thing about
but they're Christians, okay? So
yeah,
they're entitled,
yeah.
And they don't necessarily feel obliged so to do.
You know, they do this a lot. This is something that is getting more and more common with a lot of in a lot of other churches. They'll take like R&B and pop and contemporary songs, and I mean even the most subversive, creepy. Even the most subversive dark songs or whatever, or extremely sexual, and they'll turn them into these
turn it into happy hymns. Jesus music.
Yeah, you're like, but even if you do that, it's like the intent is still there, and it's like you're only fooling yourself. I mean, if it works for you and it works for your service, I guess. But I mean, it's so hilarious. But and the other thing I wanted to mention was I think the whole thing, the whole situation that we, what is it? I just read today that the Air Force is spending $4 million a day in Libya. And to me, it's just sickening to think about all that money.
That's all? Hell, one cruise missile. But I guess we're blaming the cruise missiles on the Navy, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, I mean, to think about all the money, and, you know, the other thing is that all these community organizations that could use any of those, any of that amount of resources, and to be able to use it effectively versus something so with so much waste. It, to me, you know, the whole thing about it is it just really speaks to our whole culture in what we do. And maybe it speaks to our, you know, I was watching the whole thing with Libya, and they're bringing out this guy. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's a French philosopher. His name is Bernard Henri Levy, and he's on the TV everywhere. I'm sure Sandra's aware of him. And one of the guys was bringing up a critical thinking point about Libya and the rebels. And he goes, do you even know who the rebels are? And this Bernard Henri Levy flies off the handle and says, because the guy was bringing up, he said, you know, you are getting in bed with jihadists. And this was Bernard's response, his retort. Please name me one name of the jihadist, sir. One name of the jihadist. Name me one name of the jihadist, sir. And the guy was like stunned. He's like, I don't know the name of the jihadist. He's like, so you can't name me a name of the jihadist. And apparently, I guess Bernard Levy is the guy that convinced Sarkozy to go in with the Libya airstrikes.
Oh, dear God.
And it's just interesting to see the whole humanitarian intervention all of that play out on mainstream media, and to see how many people, you know, I mean, I'm going to speak again to people who think the humanitarian intervention is good. You don't know who you're dealing with, and you really don't know what the backlash is going to be. And the other thing that was really interesting, Bob, was how they kept saying, oh, but we avoided a slaughter in Benghazi. We avoided a slaughter in Benghazi, and the expert on Libya was talking about how, well, you may have avoided the slaughter in Benghazi, but here are some hot points that you didn't pay attention to that are going to flare up because of our intervention. And they still wanted to pretend. I mean, they brought out Zagnu Bravinsky, and he was talking about the same thing about out of Libya. And I mean, it's so amazing, the stubbornness that comes. And nobody wants to say, you know what? I could be mistaken on this. And I mean, that's the human thing to do, and that's the thing that but we never see that. And you know, the thing is that when we have a situation in Libya like this, and when someone is constantly telling you how many lives we saved, to me it's such a fucking straw man. It's so ridiculous. And I mean, you say you saved lives, I mean, and then to actually this intent that you care about Libya. Really, did you care about Libya 4 years ago? Huh? Did you care about it 3 years ago? And the other thing is you know, the situation, it's all over in the Middle East. You know how people talk about...
Well, you just got an amen from Sandra.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at the thing in Egypt, what was happening, here's the thing that really people should start to, you know... They should start to think about, because, you know, my mom was talking about this to me, and I said, you couldn't be even more right. And she was like, you know, all the people in Egypt who were protesting were pretty much, you had a really young base out there, and they were college students. She was, I wonder if the college students would have protested for the poverty that the poor were experiencing in Egypt years ago, and if they've ever protested that. And the point is, we never protest for the poor people. We never do.
No, and no successful revolution has ever mounted by the poor. All successful revolutions begin and flower inside the bourgeoisie. I mean, that's just a fact.
Right, and
the other thing is that there is a historical precedent, though very, very few people know it, of the Egyptian people doing this. And you know what? There is such a thing as collective memory. And there is such a thing as, you know, stirrings down in your belly or whatever, especially when your belly's empty. My God, the Egyptian people have been rioting over when bread got short for 5,000 years.
My only concern is I hope that the Libyan rebels, they don't turn out to be, this doesn't turn out to be a set-up prop war. And these are basically teabaggers with assault weapons of the Libyan persuasion. That's the point, Bob. I don't know. Nobody.
Yeah, and you know, I got an email a few minutes ago from our dear friend Jude out in the Northwest.
Right.
And she was pointing out the fact that doctrines endorsed by the Obama administration, and I mean, so we're watching what's going on in Fukushima, and I got an email from Dave a little bit ago saying with a headline from the Wall Street Journal, TEPCO, radioactive water leak into sea has been stopped, according to the Kyodo Press, KYODO.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, God, I hope this is true. Yeah, me too. But by the same token, I get this email from Jude a few minutes ago that just chilled me to the damn bone. Okay, dig this. Here we go.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, of course, this is in concert with the fact that, you know, we're doing Libya now. The preemptive nuclear doctrine, DJNO, endorsed by the Obama administration, allows for the preemptive use of mini-nukes in conventional war theaters directed against rogue states. While the guidelines do not exclude other more deadly categories of nukes in the U.S. NATO nuclear arsenal, Pentagon scenarios in the Middle East and North Africa are currently limited to the use of tactical nuclear weapons, including the B-61-11 bunker buster bomb. The fact that Libya had been singled out by the Pentagon for a possible 1997 mini-nuke trial run was a significant element in the formulation of the 2001 Nuclear Posture Review. Did you get that?
Yeah.
Libya was singled out by the Pentagon for a possible 1997 mini-nuke trial run. You know what, David? I don't think there's any such thing as a nuclear trial run.
And you know what's funny? This all ties together. And guess who's coming out on the... I noticed they brought him out on the whole the Libyan invasion on for support for the airstrikes and quote-unquote humanitarian intervention. That guy from Syriana, Robert Baer, the CIA operative.
Oh yeah.
But one last thing I wanted to mention was you were talking about how you were going to miss Anthony Bourdain last night.
Yeah.
You didn't miss it.
Oh, no new show?
No new show. Next week is Brazil, so the gods love you, Bob.
No, they don't because Butler was an absolute disaster.
You just had to. You know, one last thing before...
Jesus, I mean, it was like somebody had a garbage can lid over the hoop.
But one last thing, I have to comment on this, one last thing before I go. And when you said doing Libya, you just invented a new genre, foreign policy porn.
Oh.
That would be a good DVD, doing Libya series.
Jesus, God.
And you know, someone's thinking, oh my God!
Well, I mean, that's what we... I mean, no, we're doing Libya, aren't we?
we're more than doing Libya. That's a whole new level of gonzo style. We're doing Libya. We're doing the Middle East. I just can't wait until...
Well, you remember George Bush before the invasion of Iraq, when somebody the Newsweek reporter was there and heard somebody say, but Mr. President, what about Saddam? And dim leader, and these were his words, so I'm not just being vulgar for the sake of vulgarity, dim leader turned and said, fuck Saddam, we're taking him out. Well, I mean, what's the difference between that and fuck Gaddafi? I'm sorry, in a different voice.
Yeah.
Fuck Gaddafi, we're taking him out.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be where we're at, and I just have to wonder, and I'm sure you're wondering too, since I did bring up Syriana, and what will we do about Saudi Arabia? What will we do about that? When that explodes, if it explodes, what are you going to do about that? When oil goes up to 200 a barrel, what are you going to do about that? We're going to pretend like nothing's happening there and not help our fellow Saudi Arabians? I think that's pretty much what's going to happen.
Oh, no, 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 no. We will be there on the side of the Saudi government. That's why we haven't had anything to say about Saudi, much of anything to say, about Saudi knee breakers going into Bahrain. Because, you know, we don't want a bunch of the Bahraini unwashed just rabbling through the streets. We've got a damn Navy base there.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And, next week, set your programming for your mental mind.
Well, you know, they pissed me off over at the Travel Channel because the new Bourdain's used to run at 10 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah.
No, it's 9 now. And that just sucks because that means I have to close the show and just go sprinting out of the studio and bull. But
I did find this.
No, I'm still chilled by the Nicaragua episode.
Yeah, that was a lesson to be learned.
He's got a couple of Emmy moments between Haiti and Nicaragua this year, without a doubt. The Ozarks episode didn't do so much for me.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from there on that. But yeah, the whole scene with the trash dump. Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, my kid's that old.
Yeah, I mean just that whole visual. And since you were talking about the Anthony Bourdain, I have found a site that archives the show. So
oh, cool.
I'll send that along to you.
Oh, do please, because I know people who would love to have that link.
All right, but juggling Pandora boxes. That's what we want to be doing.
That, with greasy fingers.
Yes, exactly.
All right, take it easy, David.
All right, later.
Bye now. Oh, darn, I forgot to ask David if he had heard the news. You're going to love this. You know those murals in Arizona? The U.S. Labor Department has told the governor, LePage, to either put the mural back up or pay for it. Now, what does a Republican hate doing more than anything else unless he's spending taxpayer money to hire one of his cronies' 26-year-old college dropout sons with 2 DUIs? That's right, giving away money. A senior U.S. Labor Department official has written a letter to the LePage administration saying that he's got two choices. He can either put the damn murals back up. We understand, however, that the mural is no longer... Did I say Arizona? Maine. What? Where? I'm so confused. No, Maine, LePage, whatever. Are we square? We understand, however, that the mural is no longer on display in your headquarters. Thus, it is no longer being used for an administrative purpose permitted by the Reed Act. Accordingly, the state must return it to its UTF, Unemployment Trust Fund, account, the amount of the Reed Act funds represented by the mural. So it remains to be seen whether, because I want to know, oh, sorry, didn't mean to say Arizona, meant Maine. Where did Arizona come from? But anyway, it will be interesting to see, because these right-wingers, they don't give a damn. Federal government, and remember, LePage is a teabagger. He's going to resist putting that up. They did say he could put it up in another... A building relating to employment security or something. At which point, an old boathouse down by the harbor will be designated a warehouse for the Department of Employment Security, and they'll hang the murals in there. Sheesh. Let's keep things rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, what's up, Tony?
How you doing?
I'm hanging in there. How about you?
Oh, I'm good. It's getting hot out here. You know, you remember what it was like last time we were here.
Yeah, but that was July. I mean, it's already hot, and it's April the 5th.
Yeah, it's getting warm. Hey, who's your team in the Final Four again?
Oh, I just wanted to see Butler do it.
And how many houses could they have built with all the bricks they threw up?
Jesus, I know. I mean...
They're gonna rebuild Katrina with all the bricks.
Oh my God! It was just astonishing. Did you watch it?
You know, to be honest with you, I can't truly say I'm a Final Four, but I did watch the last game, and
Just, I mean, it was just, it was 40 minutes of doink.
Brick, brick.
Brick.
Three little piggies are building houses.
Yeah, I thought they were dismantling the building they were playing in, just throwing one brick at a time. Bless their hearts, you know. But they suffered the defeat really in really classy fashion.
Yeah.
And so our buddy Corey in the free state of Louisville is taking it. Well, he was kind of rooting for him anyway, for UConn anyway. But he's got the long philosophical view on it, saying that he looks forward to his Louisville Cardinals beating the national champions three times next year.
Wow. I wish I could say I was a bigger fan of college ball, but, you know, I watched the last game. I don't really know.
Well, let's see. Next on my schedule is the Masters. And of course, baseball started back up, so I'm okay there. But, you know, the real fingers drumming on the table will start about August 1st when I start sweating the new college football season. And, yeah, I know that makes me shallow. I'm not all deep and stuff. But every now and then, you know, we've all got to get away. I mean, I carp and complain, Tony, about American Idol and stuff. But you know what? There's a difference between disappearing yourself for a little bit and living in front of the damn thing.
Yeah, tell me about it. I mean, I love Bourdain. Whenever I see Bourdain, I feel like I'm right there. He makes you feel like you're actually walking next to him sometimes. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I've got this little bit of video. One of these days I got to learn how to do YouTube stuff. I got this little bit of video I shot with the phone while we were in a restaurant in St. Thomas, Ferg and I. And it's just me looking at him across the table saying, "And what are we doing today, Ferg?" And he goes, "WWTE. What would Tony eat?"
That's a good one.
And I've got video of him turning red, tasting the classic Indian hot sauce and stuff like that. It was beautiful.
Hey, listen, that Bubble Genius commercial, is that you and your family doing that?
Oh, no. That's the Bubble Genius bunch.
Oh, I thought it was you guys.
We need to cut one, though. We need to put together a Bubble Genius ad. And we need, I've been talking to John. John suggested we put a banner up on the website to make things easier for folks. Because it's a nice deal. You use the promo code HORNIE, HORNIE, you get 10% off your order, and you get a free bar of horn soap.
I'll have to check into that. We haven't spoken in a while, so if I rehash something, you don't want to talk about it anymore.
Just go where you need to go.
But first thing was Liz Taylor. I didn't really know much about, like, old time movie stars, but when you saw her face, you know, hey, there's a star. Can you help me with this on the timeline for AIDS? She was pretty much the first person to come out and...
Yeah, I mean, she was at the forefront of it. After, I think it coincided with the horror that was the passing of Rock Hudson.
Rock Hudson, yeah. You know what I'm... To me, I think that what you do... Your character is defined by what you do. And, like, at the time, people didn't really know a lot about AIDS. And let's face it, they could have... You know, a lot of people could have blackballed her. She could have been ridiculed, a pariah. But, you know, she said, you know what, I don't care what people think. This is something that's going to be bad, and this is my first.
Right, and she was so much of a star that they couldn't do that to her.
Yeah, but you know how people are, though. I mean, all it takes is one schmuck, and then everybody jumps behind him, because everybody was not afraid of her, but they respected her too much not to attack her. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because, I mean, she walked it like she talked it. I always tell it to you, like, I've said that to you before, you know, people walk it like they talk it, and they don't care what people think. That's when you know that you're dealing with the real deal. And for that, she was definitely the real deal. Because the timeline, if you look at the timeline, we were still kind of ignorant to it. And, you know, she stood her ground and she said, "This is my buddy and I'm not turning my back on him. And, you know, this is it." And so you got to give her credit for that.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And you were talking about, the other day you played a Martin Luther King speech. And I noticed something about King and his speeches. When you go through your daily life and you're doing work and something, you might hear, like on the background on TV, you might hear somebody talking or something, but no matter where you are, when King talks or they put a speech, everybody stops.
Yeah, because...
You know what I mean? They stop and they look, and they go, wow. I mean, you can hear speeches from everybody, but it's very rarely where people drop whatever they're doing and listen to the radio or stare at the TV. And like this guy, these guys bonering all these dudes, you know, they wish they could mesmerize the public the way he did. I mean, he was just, you know, his speech making was wow. You know, you could get
well, and there's and everybody talks about how Barack Obama gives great speeches. I still maintain that's because they don't know what great speech making sounds like.
Yeah, it's like whenever he talked, you could, you know, like when King talked, the hairs on the back of your neck would stand up. Because you'd be like, or you'd be overwhelmed with emotion. Like when he did his free at last speech, that was just, I mean, any speech he does is pretty much fantastic. So, I mean, I just thought I'd mention that to you because you did play his thing on TV.
Yeah.
This Cole thing you were talking about earlier, what I find interesting is if you look at any branch of technology, except for the ones where that these companies make this big money, the internet, we have wireless. We can get photos from the Mars probe with no physical connection. We can send electronic mails and we can attach files to it. You can do your show on a webcam so people can see you. How come everything is advanced, but it just seems like coal, oil, and all these other fuels haven't stepped in the 21st century? I mean, the internal combustion engine is really obsolete if you think about it. How come none of these, everything else has evolved or moved forward with technology? How come these are, they seem to be stuck in the 60s?
They're not, well, maybe the 1860s. No, I kid. I mean, the answer's really quite easy. We got, and again, hey, look, it's another plug. Go get Joe Bajan's book, Rainbow Pie, because he addresses this. We, in the post-World War II consumer culture, made some, our betters, that is, made some assumptions, Tony. One of those assumptions was that we were going to have all the oil we wanted forever. You know, as a child, I remember the lowest price I ever saw for gasoline, I think, was 29 cents a gallon. And it had been much cheaper than that.
I remember 53.
But I'm a little bit older. So
I'm older than you.
Are you older than me?
I'm 55, dude.
Oh, damn. Okay, well, and I remember that the Sinclair station or whatever out Petersville, 29.9. But we thought we were going to have an endless supply of oil, therefore we built the entire economy around it.
Yeah.
You know, coal was there, and we had a vibrant steel industry, and just burn all you want. Because things like global warming were, at best, distant on the horizon.
Yeah.
And it was a cheap, easy way to artificially maintain a consumer-based economy that would prop up a wartime economy that didn't want to deflate.
Yeah.
And so consequently, we stayed with it. But even after the oil crisis, you know, people like Jimmy Carter said, maybe we need to start thinking about alternative energy sources. And he was made mockery of for it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because it violated... It violated that age-old toxic thing that afflicts the United States called manifest destiny.
Yeah.
You know, we've got this idea, and it hides behind cheap, tired old ad slogans like American exceptionalism. We've got this notion that we were made to rule the world. And so what if 5% of the world's population consumes and just throws away gratuitously 25% of the world's resources? Well, America was always going to be on top because we were made to rule. But while we were out there thinking we were made to rule, here comes India, here comes China, and now we're in a hell of a fix. Because oil isn't forever, and coal isn't forever, and gas isn't forever. But because those industries control more capital than just about any other industry on the planet, they get to dictate what songs we dance to at the party.
Yeah, it's like I told you before. we have a huge natural nuclear reactor sitting right out there in the sky, and while we don't harness the power of the sun, it just doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? It's right there, and like Nevada. I mean, I don't know how sunny it gets where you're at, but it's sunny here a lot. I mean, this town could, we could produce energy and sell it to the world.
Well, there is enough solar potential inside a 45 square mile grid in Nevada to power the entire United States a couple of times over. But what we lack is the technology for delivering that electricity. And based on some emails that I've received from our buddy who is a real, live, honest-to-God rocket scientist, you know, that may be the philosopher's stone, universal solvent, whatever, that we don't find, because the physical leaps of getting that kind of electricity from point A to point B it's got some real hurdles, but it has to be worked on. Secondarily, though, we also have to take note of the fact that, you know, it doesn't have to be the sunlight in Nevada. My God, I watched David in Tennessee shot me a note last week and said, you know, you got to see this. And I watched first a documentary on Nova about that was the best information I'd seen about what was going on in Japan. And then secondly, right after that, there was a thing on the climate crisis, sustainable energy, and there was a guy there, and I can't remember his name, Tony, but he had all the numbers and all the figures. And he kept pointing out that it is possible for us to get away from hydrocarbon fuels if we want to. But it's that want to that's out there. You know, it rained in my bedroom last night. I've mentioned it a couple of times tonight, but it really did. And that's a pain in the ass, and I got to figure out some way to patch the roof or put on a roof because, you know, I've been talking about it for a year. Okay, never mind. But you know what? I got to do a roof. If I could do the roof on this house, and it's more or less southern facing, here in West Virginia, and put on solar panels, I'm off the grid. Even in West Virginia, I'm off the grid. No more power bill. But our government, the one entity that has the power to encourage that kind of development, isn't much interested in it because our government is a wholly owned subsidiary of Royal Dutch Shell, BP, ExxonMobil, Massey Energy, Peabody Coal, Arch Coal, Columbia, or whatever they call themselves, natural gas. And so there ain't going to be no panels on Bob's roof, and there ain't going to be no household wind turbine above Bob's house, and we're not going to have an announcement at the beginning of every program saying no mountains were harmed in the making of this program.
Well, the problem with when people complain about the cost of it, when the internet first started becoming available to the house, it was like maybe 60 or 70 bucks a month, and then it got down to 40, and then it got down to like 45 or 43. I mean, like anything, any new technology, of course it's going to be expensive at first, but the better we get at it, the cheaper it's going to get. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
Oh, and by the way, the person who was talking about all that, who was so fascinating, and I got to go back and watch it again, is Darlene just dropped me a note to tell me, is Lester Brown. Just Google him, find anything he's talking about, and you'll be inspired. This is not undoable. See, I was talking about building Grid 2.0 and how there are physical hurdles to be done to get the power from North Dakota or Nevada, you know, to Washington or New York or Philly. But the fact of the matter is, between wind, solar, and geothermal, we can power it all. You know, for instance, yeah, granted, Iceland sits on a bunch of the volcanic pockets and so forth. But you know what? They're large. Iceland, which is, you know, has a significant population. They're off the grid. They're off the grid. Iceland. You know, Iceland. Freezing effing cold. I ain't never going to go there. Iceland.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Hey, listen, I know you're running out of time. I got a couple more things to ask you. Just let me know when just comes.
Okay, well, I do kind of have to hit it because we got a couple more blinking lights, and I want to make sure we get to them.
Okay, I'll see you later.
All right, see you, Tony. Bye now.
Right, take care, bye.
Tony calling from Vegas. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm Alan.
Yes, you're on.
This is William.
Hey, William, how are you?
Oh, good, how are you?
Pretty good.
Well, I shouldn't say good, but...
Well, I mean, you know, I say that pretty good. You know, I'm above the dirt.
Yeah, there you go. I just wanted to weigh in on one thing with the gasoline and the automobile manufacturers.
Sure.
Back in junior high school, 1961, we used to have these things in our gymnasium called science fairs.
Oh, we still have them around here.
Do you? And General Motors came in there in 1961, had a 2 foot long, looked like a Corvette car, solar powered, and they shined a UVB light on it, and it moved back and forth as a working electric motor on the wheels. They told us back then this is what we'd be driving in 10 years, mind you, 1961.
Right.
In the early to mid-70s, early 70s, we had all these gas rationing issues going on. I think it happened twice. I think it was around 72 or 3, and then again in the...
75, 76?
Yeah, around that area, yeah. Now, what they did is, I worked for Ford Motor Company for 32 years, okay, as a technician and later on as management and so on. What they did at the time was come out with all these, this Ford would all just tell the technicians what was coming out. And we were going to have all these fuel-efficient four-cylinder cars, which we did, Ford Fiesta and Escort and so on and so forth.
And then, of course, Rush Limbaugh started making fun of them, and he had that parody song called In a Yugo.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But there was, I remember seeing, and I don't remember what it was, but on television years ago, I saw a documentary on a fellow that had lived in a mansion, and the staircase made Loretta Young's staircase, winding staircase, pale. And, I mean, it was like three stories high. And he advised the auto manufacturers, all of the three, big three, on what people needed. This is when the SUVs, and all of a sudden, the largest engine that Ford had for quite a few years was a 302 cubic inch V8.
Right, that 5 liter.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, what happened in the early 90s, they started coming out with larger and larger V8s.
Well, who ramped that all back up again, William?
No.
That's Chrysler's fault. With the redesign, and, you know, again, my rusty red pickup truck is a 1995 Dodge 3/4 ton with a 360 V8 in it.
Mm-hmm.
But with the redesign of the new, of what was then called the new Dodge truck, and, you know, it was a sexy looking retro design. Remember, you know, with the big hip, big hippie fender, front wheel wells and stuff.
Right.
The thing that they built that thing around was the iron block version of the V10 that they had taken to dropping in the Dodge Viper.
Mm-hmm.
And that was literally an engine design that they pulled off a shelf from, back when they were dropping it in vehicles, for military transport trucks. It was an 8 liter, and I'm not sure what that translates to in cubic inches, it was an 8 liter V10 engine. And people like me included went, well, damn, I want one. Yeah, but just V10, you get all 10 and more power.
Mm-hmm.
And bang, the race was on again because it was the early 90s. Bill Clinton was in office. I can remember at that time there was a place right on the Kentucky-Tennessee line on I-65 that had a constant gas war going on. 1992, I remember driving down there and stopping and buying gas at 50 cents a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, this is great! Of course, my views were still evolving at the time, but you know, when a junkie finds cheap clean junk, you know, you do the cheap clean junk.
Right. Sure, human nature.
But you know, Detroit, Kevin, well, we keep giving them economical cars, but they don't want them. They don't like them. And it never occurred to Detroit that was because they were designing some pretty crappy economical cars. Here, let's go through a few. The Vega.
Oh, God.
The Pinto.
The exploding Pinto. Yeah.
The Maverick. The Omni.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had a crap box. And
how about was that AMC that one? That
oh, the Pacer and the Gremlin?
The Pacer, I think, is the wide thing.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, meanwhile, Europe and Japan were designing small cars that the American people were buying hand over fist. And it never occurred to Detroit, William, that the problem wasn't the small car. The problem was the way they were designing them.
Exactly. And let me emphasize on that one aspect. When I worked at a rather large Ford dealership, all dealerships have used cars, certified used cars, basically. And they had to, in California, they have to smog them. Every Japanese car that was in there, I swear to God, you couldn't hear the engine running. You didn't even know it was running when it was on the smog machine, which is the dynamometer, right? You put any Ford on there, or anything else on there, American made, and there was always a skip and a miss and a shake and a joggle. And I always thought to myself, how can the Japanese make a car that just purrs like a kitten, and the American manufacturers couldn't make a car that could idle without missing beats, without a shake, without, you know, you're going to find that.
Yeah, or the same thing for the Germans.
Exactly.
Or the Swedes.
Exactly. And you wonder why the American car manufacturers, I mean, they had that, what was that, Mazda, they had that Wankel engine, which was a...
The rotary, yeah, rotary. That was amazing.
It was an amazing car, and they could have, and they just erased that thing. You know,
although they did eventually bring it back. Hey, William, I hate to do it, but I got to get out of here.
Okay.
Rick Smith is on the way, so we will talk soon, I hope, okay?
Very good.
Later, William. Bye now.
Bye.
My apologies to all of you who are still on hold. I tried to get to as many as I could. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. From Lottie in the chat room to our blogger Texas Betsy, our news ninjas Gene and Susan. Thanks to John Fox and Ben Birch. Thanks for the ongoing sponsorship of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.